Case number four for argument this morning is Brandner against the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Aaron Morris on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Patrick Brandner. Dr. Brandner and his wife Kelly are present in the gallery in the back row. This case, through this litigation, Dr. Brandner sought injunctive and declaratory relief seeking to enjoin the American Association of Orthopedic Surgeons and a sister organization that also goes by the same moniker, the AAOS, from suspending Dr. Brandner's membership in the organization as a result of the AAOS's failure to comply with their own bylaws and the handling of what we referred to as the Sharp-Brandner grievance. I think both parties did a great job in the briefs of laying out the case law.
There's one thing that's not laid out. I don't understand what has happened, in fact. Did the suspension take effect, and if so, when?
It has not. The district court entered the district court entered a preliminary injunction.
That was in March 2001, and it then entered final judgment on September 27, 2012. And as of the date of final judgment, that was the end of the preliminary injunction.
Correct. The counsel for both parties consulted, discussed the fact that an appeal was going to be filed, and the AAOS agreed to refrain from going forward with the punishment while the appeal was pending.
So it's by agreement of the parties. Has a public announcement been made?
It has not, Your Honor.
Except through the district court's opinion, which is as public as one can imagine.
That is correct,
Your Honor. And, of course, filing an appeal in the Seventh Circuit is going to make it even more public.
That is correct, Your Honor.
If there will be any orthopedic surgeon left in America who doesn't understand about this, that as soon as we release our opinion, that'll all be over.
That is correct, Your Honor. And to that extent, I am hopeful that this court will go to the same lengths that it did in the Austin decision. In the Austin decision, this court, while determining that Dr. Austin did not have an important economic interest that was worth protecting, could have stopped the opinion right there, but basically spent the next five pages explaining all of the reasons why Dr. Austin was not a good physician, why his testimony was not scientifically supported, why he was appropriately suspended. I'm confident that if this court reviews the facts of this case, if it reviews the briefing in this...
I don't think that's our job.
Well, I agree, Your Honor. It's not. But the simple fact is, as you've said, it's out there for all to see. As a result of this litigation, the whole world knows that the AAOS wants to suspend Dr. Brandner. And I am hopeful that this court's decision, and a published decision, will make it clear that the AAOS has not complied with its bylaws, and the process that occurred in the Sharp-Brandner grievance was not appropriate. I don't think anybody can dispute, as we sit here today, that the grievance procedures, as they are set up, are designed to give the parties, and I'll use the phrase because I used it in the depositions, one bite at the evidentiary apple. And Melissa Young, the assistant general counsel for the AAOS, admitted, yes, the way this procedure is set up, this grievance process is set up, is that the parties get one opportunity to present the evidence, to essentially cross-examine the other side on the evidence. Each side gets 30 minutes to present their case. The cross-examination time is in addition to that. That is their one bite at the evidentiary apple, and it is undisputed in this case that during, this is the COP hearing panel, during the COP hearing panel, they didn't have all the evidence because Dr. Sharp, in his grievance report, had only provided one set of deposition transcripts. Not only that, in his grievance report, he doesn't even identify the fact that there are other deposition transcripts. He makes it sound as if it was just as clear as day that there was one set of deposition transcripts. The plaintiffs in the underlying case testified that they understood about the risk of the perineal nerve before consenting to the operation, and then they essentially filed a lawsuit that said the exact opposite thing, and Dr. Brandner supported their testimony. And when Dr. Brandner shows up at the COP hearing, after three times telling the AOS he is not providing you with all of the deposition transcripts. You do not have the complete picture. The AOS ignores their own grievance procedure, which is grievance procedure 6C, which says both parties have an obligation to produce all materials. The exact language is each party to a grievance is responsible for obtaining and providing all written material, such as transcripts and medical records, for consideration by the AOS. Dr. Sharp did not do that, and nobody on behalf of the AOS requested that Dr. Sharp do that. And so what you had was Dr. Brandner's one bite at the evidentiary apple consisted of one-third of the relevant transcripts. It was only after I got involved and threatened litigation against the plaintiff's attorney in the underlying litigation that Dr. Brandner was able to get possession of these subsequent transcripts.
He had an opportunity at the Judiciary Committee to correct that, didn't he?
At the Judiciary Committee, you get 10 minutes to essentially make comments upon why the decision of the COP hearing panel was incorrect. It is not an opportunity to go into any kind of depth with respect to a review of evidence. It is not an opportunity to go into the kind of analysis that would be required to address those deposition transcripts. But you're correct. By the time we got to the Judiciary Committee, the transcripts had been produced, not by Dr. Sharp, not at the request of the AOS, but because I threatened a lawsuit against the attorney who had represented the plaintiff. But the reality is Dr. Brandner's bite at the evidentiary apple, the COP hearing panel, those transcripts were not available, nor were the transcripts available from the district court, from the actual trial transcript. We provided those as well. So basically, you have your COP hearing panel that has essentially one-third of the relevant transcripts in the case, and that's when Dr. Brandner gets his one bite at the evidentiary apple. And, Your Honor, your question with regard to the Judiciary Committee leads into the discussion of the recasting of the grievance. And this is something that, as a person who was involved with the appeal, I find this particularly frustrating. The grievance report that was filed by Dr. Sharp was very clear. It alleged that Dr. Brandner had violated certain mandatory standards for certain reasons. Dr. Brandner showed up at the COP hearing and made all of the arguments as to why the claims in Dr. Sharp's grievance report were not factually or legally supported. The determination that the COP hearing panel came out was that Dr. Brandner had violated three of these mandatory standards, but not for any of the reasons that Dr. Sharp had alleged. They basically pivoted away from the allegations in Dr. Sharp's initial grievance and found on a different basis.
Counsel, you're proceeding as if you can re-argue the merits of this issue here. That's not what this is about. You might confine your attention to the legally relevant issues.
The legally relevant issues are Illinois law is clear that membership in a voluntary association is an interest of substance within the scope of judicial control. And the Illinois Supreme Court has made it clear that where you have an important economic interest that is threatened by an improper administrative process employed by a voluntary professional organization, the court has the power and the duty to act. It's the exact language, the power and the duty to act. And we have, through our briefing, and I know we've gone through a number of issues that we raise with the AOS's handling this matter, but specifically the issues that cannot be questioned are the AOS's noncompliance with their own bylaws. Well, and it's the
saying that Dr. Brandner can't be a witness in the future because he's been suspended from the Orthopedic Surgeons Union for helping out with a malpractice case. I would think that would increase his credibility, not decrease it.
It's not the way it works. What you have is the AOS trying to say that Dr. Brandner has fallen below his standard of care as an expert witness. And it's interesting, in this instance, the decision that best supports me in this is actually one raised by the AOS. The AOS, in their brief, came back and directed this court's decision to the Haney decision out of Pennsylvania. And they try to say, look, here in Haney, in this Pennsylvania case, Dr. Austin, which this court approved happily his suspension from another similar academy, he was still able to testify. If you actually read the Haney decision, it is the court basically saying, I can't believe plaintiff would hire this guy because he has been suspended from this organization. And the dissent in that opinion actually goes through and says, based on the suspension of this witness and the Seventh Circuit's opinion with respect to how poor a witness this is, I wouldn't let this guy testify at all. He didn't even want to discuss the Frye aspect of that decision. So, yes, Your Honor, the reality is if Dr. Brandner, and just to be clear, it's undisputed that Dr. Brandner's reputation is impeccable. His professional database is clear. He's never had an issue like this. For all intents and purposes, his reputation is beyond question.
Does the record contain any data about the effect on other members who have been suspended for a year?
It does not, Your Honor.
It sounds like what we have on the question whether an important economic interest has been affected is just lawyers' talk rather than evidence.
Sounds like
something on which evidence would be essential.
No. Well, you have an affidavit of Dr. Brandner discussing the importance of...
It's physician's talk as well. That is, he makes a prediction. The question I'm asking is whether any predictions, whether by the plaintiff or the lawyers, have been tested against actual experience.
No. There was no evidence brought in by the AOS to dispute.
They're the defendants. It's the plaintiffs who have the burden.
Correct. You have an affidavit of Dr. Brandner that explains the fact that he is surgically disabled, the fact that 73% of his income is derived from providing expert medical testimony, and from the fact that without that income, he cannot meet his overhead obligations.
But it's just a prediction that he won't have income. Now, physicians keep saying that we need evidence-based medicine. Judges keep saying we need evidence-based law. Statements, top-of-the-head statements about what people think, not checked against real-world experience, are very difficult to use as the basis of a judgment.
Your Honor, I think it's safe to presume as a practicing attorney, and I think anybody who is a practicing...
We presume nothing. We rely on what facts show.
Well, I believe... Well, we are not suing for monetary damages. I think your argument... Which is advanced.
I'm not making any argument.
Pardon me, Your Honor. Your statement, which is actually raised in Austin more as dicta than anything, deals with a situation where a physician who has been suspended is seeking monetary damages for a loss of his income. And the question there was, well, the issue that was raised was, how can this physician really say that these damages were caused by his suspension? We are not Austin. We are not seeking monetary damages. We are seeking to prevent what would clearly be the harm of an important economic interest. That is the purpose of this litigation. We have not asked...
The word clearly is not a substitute for evidence.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
The word clearly is not a substitute for evidence.
Well, in this instance, we're speaking about what the claims are in the complaint. The claims in the complaint are for equitable and declaratory relief.
The complaint are not a substitute for evidence. There must be... Associations like this regularly suspend their members. In fact, you gathered evidence about the number of suspensions and how many of them testified for plaintiffs and how many of them testified for defendants. Why not gather evidence about the economic consequences of suspensions? You know, one potential view of this is that your client is not only remains a board-certified medical professional, but also is a member of other associations. And therefore, the suspension, although annoying, won't kill his practice. The other possibility is his prediction that it will kill his practice. This can be tested with evidence. I'm just wondering why it hasn't been subjected to testing.
At no point did the AOS rate... Well, the AOS...
They are the defendants. The evidence comes from plaintiffs.
Correct. Through the affidavit and through the deposition testimony of Dr. Brandner, he made it clear that it was his belief that his suspension from the AOS...
Look,
understood.
Could you address my question? I've said previously that a person's beliefs differ from evidence. We need to check beliefs against the world. I'm just asking why that hasn't been done.
Because we were not suing for money damages.
Okay.
I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Chabrahas.
May it please the court. The three AAOS committees that heard the grievance all concluded that the plaintiff had violated the standards of professionalism on orthopedic expert witness testimony. Now, plaintiff clearly disagrees
with
the
plaintiffs. Can we pursue a little the question I just asked Mr. Morris? Does the association keep any evidence about this issue?
I'm not aware of any evidence.
Probably not. It doesn't ask its members to submit information about their annual incomes, I assume.
That's correct.
Do you know whether there have been any empirical studies of this question?
I'm not aware of any studies addressing...
You'd think the association would take account of the likely monetary consequence of its actions when it decides whether to suspend somebody. And in order to do that, it would have to know what they are.
As I said, Your Honor, I'm not aware of such studies being
done. Well, that's different from the question whether there have been any. Did you try to find out whether there have been any?
I've not tried, and as I said, I'm not aware that there are any.
Awareness doesn't arrive unless somebody tries to find out.
Well, you haven't challenged the proposition that this guy is out of business.
But, Your Honor, on that issue of economic interest,
I think it's a fair question. Is he or isn't he out of business?
Well, I think it's entirely speculative. Now, membership in good standing is not
speculative on this record, but since the association suspends people from time to time, it should be easy to find out what happens. Do they vanish? Do they all become photographers or architects?
Your Honor, the association is very much
worse, lawyers?
That the members who have been suspended continue to testify as experts and continue to engage in their practices. Now,
I mean, it's a good question for cross-examination, I suppose. But I'm not sure it should put them out of business. Maybe it should, I don't know, but we don't have any evidence on that.
You know, when you look at the issue of economic interest, I think the Austin court really focused on the nature of the association. The AAOS is a voluntary association. It's not necessary for board certification, for state licensure, and it's not necessary to testify as an expert. And the AAOS isn't the only association that Dr. Brander belongs to. He belongs to many others. And in Trister...
Well, I think we might guess that it was not encouraging malpractice cases.
It's that maybe I'll be right, Your Honor. But in Trister, the Illinois Appellate Court viewed membership in the AAOS and said it's not an economic necessity. It may be a credential that's used to bolster one's reputation, but it's not a necessity. In Austin, Seventh Circuit looked at the nature of a national association of neurosurgeons, and it found there was no economic interest and focused on the fact that where membership is optional, expulsion or suspension is not deemed an important economic interest. Now, if you look at the amount of income that a member may earn while testifying as an expert in determining whether there's an economic interest, the risk that you run is placing that member on different footing than other members. The AAOS has many other members, many of whom the great majority of their income is derived from the practice of orthopedic surgery. And if you draw a distinction based on income as an expert, you may have some members who have an economic interest in their membership, while others who don't. Now, in order for there to be judicial review of this grievance, it was plaintiff's burden to show that the AAOS had failed to abide by its internal rules, that there was a failure to afford due process, or that its actions were influenced by bias. We'd submit that the record here demonstrates that it's failed to make the showing and the entry of summary judgment was proper. I want to touch briefly on plaintiff's contentions the AAOS violated its grievance procedures. And he focuses primarily on an argument that the AAOS improperly shifted the burdens of production and proof from Dr. Sharp, the grievant, to plaintiff. And the premise of the argument is that the AAOS should have required the grievant, Dr. Sharp, to produce any and all deposition transcripts from the underlying malpractice action. But neither the grievance report nor the grievance procedures required this. Section 3 of the grievance report that Dr. Sharp submitted required him to attach copies of any documents he relied upon as evidence. And Section 6C of the grievance procedures merely provides that each party is responsible for providing transcripts and materials it wishes for the AAOS to consider. The district court correctly found this language simply means that each party is responsible for providing copies of materials they want the association to consider. Plaintiff would like to read language into the grievance procedures and the grievance report that the grievant was somehow required to produce any and all records, even if they weren't supportive of his grievance. That language just not there. Record here shows there was full compliance and the burden of proof and production wasn't shifted. Now, this argument that the AAOS somehow recasted the grievance in violations of the procedures simply isn't reported by the record either. From day one of this grievance, the plaintiff was aware that the principal focus of the grievance was on the propriety of his testimony that Dr. Sharp had violated the standard of care on informed consent. And the findings of the two committees that heard this grievance, while they may be stated differently, they're based on the same issue, the propriety of Dr. Brander's testimony on the issue of informed consent. He was fully aware of these allegations from day one of the grievance. Now, there is one area addressed.
What was he actually sanctioned for? Agreeing to be a witness or what he said as a witness?
No, he was not, to be clear, he was not sanctioned for agreeing to be a witness. He was sanctioned for his testimony in deposition at trial that Dr. Sharp had violated the standard of care and informed consent when advising the patient and his mother. But the decision to become an expert at all was not a basis for the AAOS's findings. One area that is raised in plaintiff's brief, where there was a minor deviation from the procedures, at the initial hearing before the board, the chairman of the AAOS Committee on Professionalism summarized the findings of that committee to the board. And under a prior version of the grievance procedures, he was expressly authorized to do this. Under the grievance procedures that were in place and applicable to this grievance, he was to be present to answer questions of the board, but he was not supposed to have given that presentation. Because of that, the AAOS declared that hearing null and void, and Dr. Brander was given a second hearing before the board. And that hearing was perfectly in compliance with the grievance procedures. Now, the case that plaintiff cites to Kendler v. Rutledge in support of the principle that this second hearing was somehow improper is really distinguishable. In that case, the chair of the initial committee who had heard the grievance was also a decision-making, a voting member of the second committee who heard the appeal of that grievance. That dual role isn't present here. The chair of the Committee on Professionalism, although he presented to the board, did not have a vote on the board. And similarly, no one on the board played any role in the Judiciary Committee or the Committee on Professionalism's findings. I want to touch just briefly on the argument plaintiff makes that he wasn't afforded due process. The principal case he cites to Virgin, a member of the American College of Surgeons was expelled, and that the court annulled that expulsion. The court there found that the member hadn't been provided notice of the charges, he hadn't received the charges, he hadn't been allowed to confront his accusers, and he wasn't provided a fair hearing. The record here is markedly in contrast to Virgin. Dr. Brander received the charges. He received copies of all the supporting materials. He was given the opportunity to respond in writing.
I must say I'm completely lost by the due process argument. You're not conceding that your clients are state actors, are they?
No, no. My argument here is that...
Well, due process clause applies only to state actors.
My argument here is that Dr. Brander was afforded a rudimentary due process, right to a fair hearing. Unless there are any other questions, Your Honors, I'll conclude my remarks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Morris?
Yes, Your Honor.
With respect to Mr. Chabria's mention of the fact that there was a second board hearing, this is the reason why I mentioned the bite at the evidentiary apple. That bite does not occur at the board level. The first point I made to the second board was that this would not cure the procedural defects which had occurred in this case. What needed to occur was another COP hearing. There needed to be another hour-long hearing, 30 minutes each side, with the deposition and trial testimony that had been excluded in the first place. Mr. Chabria mentions, with regard to this economic interest, he mentions two cases, Treister and Austin. Treister is a very different case. Treister is an exclusion case. It is not an expulsion case. The Illinois courts have made it clear that the different standards with respect to economics apply when you're dealing with an exclusion case versus an expulsion case. If it's an expulsion case, you need to have an important economic interest. If it's an exclusion case, meaning somebody is trying to become a member and the organization is saying no, you need to show economic necessity. We are in an expulsion case. All we need to show is an important economic interest, and there is no, the evidence in this case shows that 73% of Dr. Bradner's income, the income which makes it possible for him to continue the practice of outpatient orthopedics, is derived from medical legal support. So we clearly satisfy the important economic interest standard. I don't want to get caught up too much in the due process issue. That's not the basis that we have. Our appellate brief is careful in stating that of the three grounds that Illinois courts recognize to annul expulsions, due process, bias or prejudice, and violation of grievance procedures, our appeal is focused on violation of bylaws and grievance procedures and bias and prejudice. And then lastly, I would ask
the court counsel. The case is taken under advisement.